Jema. We start with a question that has been often asked: what is the use of all this knowledge when we can just have faith and faith is sufficient? Well, faith, if we go into our own thought, faith is a beginning. It must culminate in knowledge. Because it's not enough that we have faith, that everything is fine, everything is good. And very often we see that human beings keep this faith as long as everything is going good by our standards and yardsticks. But when things don't go fine based on our ideas, our understanding, our yardsticks, then sometimes we question faith as early as just now sitting in dispensary. Someone comes and says, I had so much faith in Sri Aurobindo and the mother, and therefore I stopped someone from doing something which he is not supposed to do. And see, I have been punished. So I said, what is the punishment? I have been sent to another department. I said, wow, what is punishment about it? You should be very happy. So it's your idea of justice, your idea. We never question our own idea. He said, usual standard thing, that person is, like an asura and I am like... I said, by revolting against the divine, you are not becoming closer to the divine. You are displaying the very same qualities. The right way is with humility to understand, to seek to understand why things are the way they are. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is explaining to us. And as we grow in knowledge, we grow closer to the divine. That's how the Gita says, Jigyasu and Jnani are the Param Bhaktas. Strangely, it used the word Bhakta. So, we grow in knowledge. Knowledge is very much an aspect of the divine and we need to grow in knowledge. And of course, that knowledge is not a book knowledge, but it starts by in some way, somewhere we read and then we grow into that. So, it's also when we love someone, I often use this analogy, that if you love someone, you would like to know what the person is doing and why the person is doing. It's an aspect of love. It's not questioning as a doubt, but and when you understand it, it actually increases the way you have connected with the person. Say with your mother, with your father. So many people I see, they have this kind of broken relationship. And simply because they have a fixed notion, fixed idea, and they never change their idea, they never evolve, grow, and they have the fixed idea based on which they are judging everything, everyone, including God. But if we say that, maybe, I do not know, I need to know, it requires tremendous humility. And the biggest problem is the more we live in the illusion of knowledge because we have read scriptures, because somebody has put us as Madhadhish and Mahamandaleshwar, some Upadhi, we start believing that I already know. And there are many unanswered questions. I'm not saying this just as an article of faith. Like all of us, I'm sure, I have read almost all the scriptures, accessible scriptures. And they didn't answer certain fundamental questions. For example, one of them was the question of karma. So, the final thing is all the burden is passed on man's karma. So, I used to enjoy one of the things that, Umar Khayyam writes, O thou who with pitfall and with jinn beset the road I was to travel in, wouldst thou with predestination around impute me for my fall to sin? So this is a question that man is so incomplete, man is so ignorant, so weak. He didn't ask to be so, and then can you really impute him done a big crime? If we read the Gita, Sri Krishna uses this word. He says, Yantra Rudhine Maya. People are driven as a fly on the wheel. Now you can't blame a fly which is sitting on a wheel. So sometimes when we use the word karma, the way it is understood, there is a truth of law of karma, but that's not what we are reading here. We'll read about that also. Every question is answered in the life divine. But point is that, after all, most human beings are pretty helpless, pretty ignorant. And when you read through all this, you feel immense compassion of Sri Aurobindo. He had no need to explain all this. He could have just given a stock answer. Your karma. As you sow, so will you reap. And you begin to wonder, when did you sow what you are reaping today? And what is going to happen thereafter? So all these stock answers which are there, even in Indian thought, which is most profound. Another option is that, well, it's all the will of God. And again, as we said, that Khalil Gibran's question, that between the infinitesimal and the infinite, somebody has taken away my child. Could someone explain why this has happened? So, infinitesimal as the bacteria and infinite is the will of the infinite. So this urge to know, and human beings are programmed for that today or tomorrow. That's why one thing is certain, that religions are dated. Whether we like it or we don't like it, sects are dated. A time will come when man's quest will increase. He will want to know more. He'll want to understand more. And this is inevitable. Now, there are some people in whom this urge to know more has started, which is very good. And Sri Aurobindo gives us the answer to those questions which we do not even care to raise. One of the questions being the law of karma. I don't know. I am born weak. I am born. Many people say this. That, well, I don't have strength enough. I don't even have the knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. This there in the Mahabharata. He says that I know what is sin, but I don't have nivrati from it. And I know what is good and I don't have pravrati for it. So, hey Keshav, you are seated in my heart, drive me along. So, these are genuine questions. And Sri Aurobindo takes all of them for us. And answers them, leaving nothing. Because when we read Savitri, then we get that vision. On one side, we have the law of karma. Again, there is a truth of it, but not the way it is understood popularly. But what does he write in Savitri? Narad Ashupati is surprised that why my daughter has to suffer this fate. It is the original question asked to Rishi Markande before Savitri's story is narrated. That why Draupadi has to suffer such a fate. So Markande Rishi doesn't give that, you know, she had done this bad karma and therefore she has to suffer. She says, I'll tell you the story of someone even more stronger and pious and beautiful who went through. Now, it's strange because he should have simply said, you know what, in her previous life she had done this. He doesn't do that. He narrates the story of Savitri. And then in that story, this question comes naturally. Ashwapati raises this question. Just like Yudhishthir asking this question to Markande Rishi, that why my daughter has such a fate? She has chosen someone who is going to die after 1 year. The queen simply laments. She says, like the common man, that, well, God is like that. He is an indifferent witness watching over us. He is enjoying this play. He doesn't know how we are caught. Our arguments are typical dualistic ideas about God. But Ashwapati asks this question to Narad, that why, after all? And then Narad's answer, O king, though random seems the way through which our footsteps turn, yet our least stumblings are foreseen above. Now, this is something very strange. First time we have a divine being, if you want to put it, who takes full responsibility for his creation. First time in the life divine, we'll see the divine first, and which is what we want. That after all, if you are all powerful, there must be a logic why things are happening. Please tell us. Because so he is taking full accepting his responsibility and explaining to us. So he says that our least stumblings are foreseen above. Cry woe, cry woe. The world cries in vain. Yet conquers the eternal good at last. So all this is there in Savitri. There is a meaning in each curve of fate. There is a meaning in each curve and line. So this is now explained in great length in The Life Divine. So without delaying much. So we are on page 407, the divine and the undivine. So on one side, we have in our heart a feeling that something is undivine. It's a feeling that we all have about certain things. Now this may differ from age to age, situation to situation, but everybody carries within him something that this should not be, this should not happen. And everybody has within each one something about what life should be, how things should be, some kind of a dream of perfection, however limited. But on the other hand, we are told all is a divine manifestation. Whatever is happening is the will of the divine. If you say that, you have a serious problem. The problem is there are brutal things. Actually brutal things. There are rapes, murders of worst kind. You can't just say that it is all divine manifestation. We must understand why this is happening and what is the purpose, if at all there is a purpose. And that's where we see the karma theory. Now karma theory, the man who is a brute, a crude human being, he has no clue what he is doing. He is just running after pleasure and that's it, his life. So we need to take full account. So Sri Aurobindo starts from there, page 407. That when we say that all is a divine manifestation, even that which we call undivine, we mean that in its essentiality all is divine. Even if the form baffles or repels us. So in its essence everything is divine. Meaning thereby there is a divine purpose, there is a divine wisdom, intelligence behind it. But definitely the form is something which is, surely it is repulsive to the advancing human consciousness. And we have to bring in the concept of time and evolution, otherwise impossible. What was perfectly normal some time back, you see, when you read even days of Mahabharat. In Mahabharat, there is no court of law. There is instant justice. You don't like, you are a Kshatriya, you take out the sword and you finish. Now you do it today. Can we do it today? Now people who say, no, no, world has not progressed. No, we need to question why you did that. Only in extreme self-defense you are justified. So there is a kind of mental intelligence which feels the need. There is not a question of taking out a gun and killing someone because that's how natural justice works. So now there is a divine consciousness which is pressing. And what may have been at one point of time very natural becomes not natural. I mean, that's why in today's times, if Sri Krishna beheaded Shishupal, there would have been a court case. First of all the leftists would have said, you prove that he gave you 100 galis. Why didn't you file a case in the court? Now, this also we have gone to an extreme. So something new is going to emerge. 100% anarchy is going to come because this is the path towards ultimately self-deliverance. Because all the rules, logic, they are not solving the problem. Reason came, it tries to solve. But cases will drag on. Today only I was seeing a figure in Indian courts, even in the Supreme Court, there are 1,490 cases which are dragging on for years. So we have left behind something. Now we have reached here. But we realize this also is limited. So we are being pushed in that direction of first anarchy and then the recovery of the inner law of truth. But that's a long passage. Let's not talk of these things right now. Or to put it in a formula to which it is easier for a psychological sense of things to give its assent, in all things there is a presence, a primal reality, the self, the divine, Brahman, which is forever pure, perfect, blissful, infinite. That's what we see in the typical stories. When Kansa is killed, before he dies, he realizes that he is the Lord and he does pranam and there is Uddhar. All his being merges into Sri Krishna. Same we see in Ravan Bhad. So this is the way we can explain it. But that's not enough. Sri Aurobindo doesn't... Another way is that we have images from the Upanishad. In certain images of the Upanishad, the divine Purusha is described as the one fire which has entered into all forms and shapes itself according to the form, as the one sun which illumines all impartially and is not affected by the faults of our seeing. The slokas he is referring to is obviously Kena Upanishad. He is referring to this. Agni riyathaiko bhuvanam pravishto. Rupam rupam prati rupo bhavuva. Eko vashi sarva bhutantar atma. Rupam rupam prati rupo bahishya. So he says that there is one self in all being. And then he gives the image of vayu riyathaiko bhuvanam pravishto. Suryo yatha sarva lokasya chakshu. Nalipyate chakshushe vahya dosha. So that power which impels us. Now what we do with that power remains unstained, which is simple to understand. Does money get stained? This is a question somebody asked Sri Aurobindo. Does money get stained because of the means by which it is earned? He says no. Money is a power. Somebody has it, he may misuse it. Someone else may use it. Why you are blaming money? It's a power. And it applies to everything. It's a power. It's the user who has used it or misused it in a certain way. He's not giving us an advice to earn black money. Advice is that money has no color. The user has the color. So, but then see, Sri Aurobindo, this is Kena Upanishad. He's saying, but this affirmation is not enough. It leaves the problem unsolved. Why that which is in itself ever pure, perfect, blissful, infinite, should not only tolerate, but seem to maintain and encourage in its manifestation imperfection and limitation, impurity and suffering and falsehood and evil. It states the duality that constitutes the problem, but does not solve it. Whole life, Agni remains inside, Vayu remains inside, pure, untouched. And here is a man misusing it for all kinds of things, creating mess. And if you go back to the history, I was happily surprised when I read Sri Aurobindo's answer on why there was an age of empires. So normally you don't like it, no? That people were coming and they were looting, plundering and one country was conquering another and so on and so forth. Today we don't like. Today we have, historically nations have formed. It was a time when nations have to be formed like that. At the same time, there was a first planning of nature that one day we must have a world unity. And when you look back, see in Anandamath, it is very beautifully described. So at the end, when the Mughals are going because of, all the Jivananda and all the protagonists of the play. So they see that Mughals are going, but the Britishers have come in. So they feel very bad that why did we fight? Did we fight for this? And then their guru says that, well, you have fought for the right cause. This now is the will of God and this will go when the time comes. Something like that along those lines. And how the will operates. For example, in one of the places the mother says, in one place she says India has to be saved from Indians. And then she says something, another very interesting thing. She foresees the possibility of an American or a Russian occupation of India. Can you imagine? And then she says Russian occupation will not help because they have mystic tendencies, so have Indians. American occupation will help both. But it will be very humiliating. It means 200, 300 years. So you see, divine works in ways which baffle us completely. But there is a master plan towards which things are moving. So in the manifestation, things are moving in a certain direction. And if you understand the goal, then we understand. Like if you see Krishna's acts in the Mahabharata, taken in isolation, you can't make sense of them. You may judge him. But when you see in the total picture, which is very obvious, that if Drona doesn't go, if Bhishma doesn't fall, it means Duryodhan will continue to be the king. And if Duryodhan is the king, the divine will which wants to fulfill itself by creating a nation. First time actually India's Aryavart is born with Mahabharata. Shri Krishna saved India. Now, either he cleans his hand and says everything is fine, you have to fight in the right way, and whoever gets, then Drona will not fall, Bhish will not fall. Duryodhan continues, and the will of the Lord to fulfill, to form Aryavart, that will not be. So there is a meaning behind everything that is happening. That's what Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us. If we simply leave these two dissonant facts of existence standing in each other's presence, that there is a divine presence within and an undivine or limited or perverted manifestation, we are driven to conclude that there is no reconciliation possible. All we can do is to cling as much as we can to a deepening sense of the joy of the pure and essential presence and do the best we may with the discordant externality. This is where our spirituality is at the most. Even the Gita, which comes closest to understanding. I mean, if there is any scripture closest to the life divine, we see the Gita, and of course, Vedas in the ancient times, the complete, not the Upanishads. And there also we see in the end, what does Sri Krishna advise? Even though he says that I am Lok Sangrahart, March of Civilizations, at the end he says, Anityam Asukham Lokam Bhajaswamam. This transient suffering world. So remember me at all times. This is the way of deliverance. Yes, for individual this problem has been solved, but the collective remains as it is. That's why Sri Aurobindo says in Savitri, escape however high redeems not life. If you escape, but life lingers. And then he completes the picture. Until we can impose in its place the law of its divine contrary. So we can say that one day Kalki avatar will come. And there are some people who believe that he will come actually on the horse, holding a whatever sword. It's height of means foolishness. You understand the imagery. He has to come. Like there are some people who believe that, you know, you have to send, you have to throw stones to counter bullets. Or you have to, you know, use birds as cannon fodders. So anyways, there are people who believe that Kalki will come on the white horse with a sword. Now it's a very clear symbol. The white horse is obviously the divine mother's force. Horse, Ashwapati. Sword is the sword of knowledge, discernment. And he is lame because one foot forward, which he has to advance against all the resistance of the world which pulls him backward. So the image is so clear. But we have to then only wait for that moment, or else we have to seek for an escape rather than a solution. So this is where human thought has gone till now. Now we'll skip a few lines, and then we have a very powerful line on page 408. The paragraph is ending, and about 5 lines above the end of the paragraph. So long as the world is not divinely explained to us, the divine remains imperfectly known. If there is, it has originated from the divine. As Guru Nanak would say, Ek bij se sab jag upja. Then it has to be explained divinely. Divine can't say, I created a world and you people messed it up. I mean, he can say, but it won't be really a... As I was saying, Anton Chekhov, that, you know, what is God doing? He is sitting up there, and you know, this world, if he is really omnipotent, he should change it. If he cannot change it, he is not omnipotent. So all that he says, and Sri Aurobindo says, you know what, God understands your problem. But man suddenly came and said, I am going to change it by science. He said, okay, continue. You also try. But what are the reports that I hear? I started by hearing that science is omnipotent and omniscient. But things are going in a mess. So is it that it is not omniscient, or is it that it is not omnipotent? The same argument he goes on there. So man will try all ways, all the different ways, till ultimately it reaches that point. Why it has to try? By each effort, however imperfect, we grow. And we have to grow to that point where the divine can express itself through us. That's the whole logic, if you see in one way, that what seems to us today childish, even when we look back at many of our own doings, it's very good time to look back. It's a very sobering experience. I'm speaking of those past 60, those who are 30 at the age when they can continue with whatever they are doing. But when you look back, you understand, if you don't justify anything, just look impersonally. And then you see that how each error was a step on the way. How it has equipped you and prepared you for where you are today. Had you not gone through it, you would have become just a typical judgmental person that this is good, that is bad, and the end of the story. But because you have gone through, and that helps you to grow and become ready to receive and manifest. So this is one explanation. Then other is, it is possible to escape from the problem otherwise. So there is the, many of us must have seen the Zen symbol, that you have the two fishes, black and white, very well, and it makes a complete whole. And the white fish has a black eye, and the black fish has a white eye. I'm sure some people would connect with the symbol. That there is no doubt, good and evil, but together they make a perfect whole now. This is one way to understand it. That perfection is not possible as an individual. But in the totality, everything is perfect. Now, this is also incomplete. You have to take account of the individual. You can't say everything is fine just because individuals are not important. So, page 409. Each thing is, this is, he is talking of the other solution. Each thing is divine in itself because each is a fact and idea of the divine being, knowledge and will fulfilling itself infallibly in accordance with the law of that particular manifestation. Each being is possessed of the knowledge, the force, the measure and kind of delight of existence precisely proper to its own nature. This applies very well to tiger and the deer, that famous aphorism of Sri Aurobindo. When tiger kills a deer, you don't say he has done something wrong or cruel. You may even go there and see it. It's on safaris, they actually show tiger kill. Everybody goes to see how a tiger is killing. So what is the tiger doing? It's hiding behind and it crouches and leaps on a little deer and it makes a meal out of it. Now, you can't say, tiger, you're doing something very wrong. That's the tiger's law of being. This problem comes only with human beings. Because we are bitten by the evolutionary bug. Because we have eaten the apple. Someone gave us the apple in the Garden of Eden. We ate the fruit of knowledge. The serpent of evolution put that bug and we ate the fruit of knowledge. And because we ate the fruit of knowledge, we have to go through the whole curve and understand everything. So, the solution here is, last five lines on this para. Because we see only parts and fragments, we judge of each by itself as if it were the whole. Judge also the external phenomena without knowing their secret sense. But by doing so, we vitiate our valuation of things. Put on it the stamp of an initial and fundamental error. Perfection cannot reside in the thing in its separateness, for that separateness is an illusion. Perfection is the perfection of the total divine harmony. Sound very nice. This is another explanation. Now that's where beauty of Sri Aurobindo, that's why he keeps saying his compassion. This is what we hear, we read, if you read Zen text, this is how it is. But he's saying no, everything. I can't say that my suffering has no relevance unless you see it in the total whole. That's sound very cruel also. So this is where he is trying to. All this may be true up to a certain point and so far as it goes. But this also is a solution incomplete by itself and it cannot give us an entire satisfaction. For example, we may say that, well, Draupadi's Chirharan was necessary so that the Mahabharata takes place and the Kuru clan dies. Sounds fine. That Pandavas had to lose the game so that they were pushed into the corner. They had no choice but to fight. Otherwise, they would have never fought and the Kauravas would have continued. But this is not a perfectly satisfactory answer. Perfectly satisfactory would be when there is no need of Mahabharata. So why this process? So all that he is explaining to us. By itself, next page, 6 lines from above. By itself, this view of things amounts to little more than the facile dogma, which tells us that all that is right, because all is perfectly decreed by the divine wisdom. That's why I say, what a compassion. When Mother said Sri Aurobindo has divine compassion, really speaking, nobody has raised these questions on our behalf. Generally, you have to just accept it. That's how it is. That divine wisdom is working inside. We cannot understand. We cannot know. Just accept it. Surrender. Have faith. But there are brutal masks. There are terrible things. And we need to take cognizance of that. Few lines below. This is not a sufficient answer to our discontent and our aspiration, which, however ignorant of their reactions, however mixed their mental motives, must correspond to a divine reality deeper down in our being. A divine whole that is perfect by reason of the imperfection of its parts runs the risk of itself being only perfect in imperfection, because it fulfills entirely some stage in an unaccomplished purpose. It is then a present but not an ultimate totality. So we can see this in the concept of the yugas. So in each yuga, we have a certain kind of perfection. In that age, there is a way of life. There is, for instance, the age of kings. So like in Treta, king. So king was the one who maintained law and order, and things were perfect up to that. But was it perfect? That's why we see in Valmiki that even, because Treta is the age of the kings. So we see that king is no less than Lord Rama. And yet, Valmiki himself shows us that this is still not, something within us feels this not right. We may explain by 100 ways. Even Rama feels this is not right, but he is compelled by the whatever limitations of the king is. Then comes Dwapar, which is the age of the codifier. So we have debates going on in the assembly. And whether it's right, whether Pandavas marrying one woman is right or not right. So there is a whole debate which goes on. Whether disrobing is right or not right. There is a debate which goes on. And it's surprising that even Bhishma shakes his head. Yeah, what you say is basically true. Draupadi is married to 5 men. So she is as good as a Vaishya. These are all there in the, you know. So something today rebels against it. But at that point of time, for those people, it was a kind of perfection that, yes, basically what Bhishma has said according to the law. Then, because there is an imperfection in it, comes Kaliyug. What is Kaliyug? Breakdown of all the codes. Why all the codes break down? Because now you have to discover the truth within the heart. That is the original Satyug. But this Satyug goes higher than this breakdown process. So now, as the mother says, my child, only that which goes deep inside your heart is true. And supermind is going to remove one of the... She was asked, what is supermind going to remove? See, if you ask me, it will put everything in its right place, evolve things to their proper place. Then she says, okay, one thing it will remove, and that is hypocrisy. And he says, only that which goes deep inside your heart is true. And we all can look at the depths of our hearts. And we all can look at our life. And that's the measure between the deepest truth and the life that we are leading. So, Satyug means you live by the deepest inner truth of your being. That's going to create a lot of problems. Because we all have our own idea of truth which we want to be implemented. And that's the reason why it is so difficult to understand the working of a place like the ashram. Because it's not based on, you know, anything which is outer. It's based on bringing out this inner truth. And it takes time because we are covered by codes and codes of falsehood. So he says, very beautiful word Sri Aurobindo has used, 2 lines from below, that we can console ourselves with this philosophic balm offered for our wounds, satisfied to move among the pitfalls of life with as much rational prudence or as much philosophic sagacity and resignation as our incomplete mental wisdom and our impatient vital parts permitted. What is the philosophical balm? See, I know you have suffered. After you die, you will have 72 or whatever. That's too crude. But you will go to Indralok where you will have nice, you know, you have suffered in this life, doesn't matter. But ultimately you will have a heaven. And that fellow who has made you suffer, you couldn't do anything to this fellow. He will rot in hell. So it gives you a philosophic balm. Ah, there is the law of karma. He is going to suffer somewhere. So there is justice. And as far as you are concerned, ultimately you will have your own day and enjoy. Not only one, double enjoyment. If you have done good deeds, you will first enjoy there and get a nice birth here. And double punishment. First you will rot in hell, then you will be born as. But it doesn't explain our phenomena of, you know, Pandavas. It would mean they first rotted in hell and then they suffered on this life. And Duryodhana must have done something very beautiful. He must have enjoyed heaven and got all the riches. So there are many things which remain unexplained. And it's good in a way, that's how I feel, that there are two kinds of line today in Sanatana Dharma. One who are just sticking on to the past and explaining everything on that basis. They're not raising questions. And there's another kind which is raising questions. And this kind which is raising questions paradoxically is ready for something greater. Because it's not that they have not read or not heard, but they want to go deeper and understand the mystery. So, Sri Aurobindo is here to explain to all of us. Now he comes to something very beautiful, that let's take a full account. Page 411, 9, 10 lines from above. There is not only a mental part in us which recognizes the imperfection, unlike the animals. So what is unique about human being? There is a psychic part which rejects it. Now comes the total account. We are not like tigers. So we may do something, but there is something in us which rejects. Rejects in the society, rejects within us, which doesn't like. So both things are there. There are two kinds of human beings. One who are enjoying, there is another kind who deep inside feel that I should not be doing this, while they are wallowing in the mud. So this is unique to human. Our soul's dissatisfaction with imperfection as a law of life upon earth, its aspiration toward the elimination of all imperfections from our nature, not only in a heaven beyond where it would be automatically impossible to be imperfect, but here and now in a life where perfection has to be conquered by evolution and struggle, are as much a law of our being as that against which they revolt. They too are divine, a divine dissatisfaction, a divine aspiration. So this is the sign and this is the kind of humanity truly ready for Sri Aurobindo's yoga. If you are happy with the standard explanations, fine, be happy. Nobody is asking you to dislodge. In fact, Mother says, don't disturb them. Because they are not ready. They are happy with whatever they have read, Life of Saints, and very nice, you know, things are there. The Gita says things and things, karma, and they are happy. Don't disturb them. But they are those who are gripped by divine dissatisfaction. Divine dissatisfaction means they want something better, they don't know how. They are not fully satisfied with all the philosophical explanations which are there. And that's why what Sri Aurobindo is saying is not philosophy, but a vision, darshan in the true sense, which he is putting into a body of words. So we may use the word philosophy, but it is his seeing. He is simply translating in a language which is consistent with reason. And this divine dissatisfaction with all that we have read, Sri Ramakrishna expresses very beautifully. There is hope for two. One, the unlettered peasant. He says, yes sir, I understand transformation. Every day I see it. Huh? You see transformation? How do you see? Sir, we see that, you know, every day near my house there is a pond. So, what do you see? He says, I see in there all kind of mud and slush. Then slowly I see out of it lotus emerging. So, I understand that human beings are that pond out of which the lotus will bloom. It's very interesting that he has got an intuitive insight. He says there is hope for these kind. And there is hope for another kind who, having read all that philosophy and scriptures offer, are yet dissatisfied and they are seeking for something more, something greater. These are the two people for whom there is hope. For the rest, they are satisfied with YouTube videos. Nice on Vedanta, on nowadays, you know, all things are there. Or with the religions, it's fine. So this is what we see, that Sri Aurobindo is explaining all this to us. And finally he says, in this light we can admit that all works perfectly towards a divine end by divine wisdom. So it awakens. There are things which awaken in us a sense of revolt, which is a sign of what things are going to be. So if one wants to see today, for example, what the world will be, let's say after 100 years. So if you see what's happening today, you will form a dismal picture. But if you see how human consciousness is reacting, what's happening inside, what is brewing inside, what is growing inside, what is developing inside, what is the aspiration inside. For instance, one thing is very certain, that the world is moving towards unity. Because human consciousness is seeking for it. It wants it. Despite everything, it wants a world where there is things which are inequity, where there are things which are, beautiful. So this is how the divine works. And there on page 412, it is a power within us, the concealed divinity that has lit the flame of aspiration, pictures the image of the ideal, keeps alive our discontent and pushes us to throw off the disguise and to reveal, or in the Vedic phrase, to form and disclose the Godhead in the manifest spirit, mind, life and body of this terrestrial creature. Our present nature can only be transitional. Our imperfect status, a starting point and opportunity for the achievement of another higher, wider and greater, that shall be divine and perfect, not only by the secret spirit within it, but in its manifest and most outward form of existence. So if you really look at this, these are the two kinds of humanity, one which is satisfied. For example, when people die, I saw recently encountering a death, there are two reactions. One is the traditional spiritual. This is the end of the body. You accept it. Vayuranilamritam achedam bhasmantam shariram. Even the Isha Upanishad. Om krato smarkatam 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 smar. That body dies, this is transient, this is nashvara. And therefore, I was just observing, so one reconciles. But there is something else also which has that love within, which wants that, how nice if this was not needed. We don't know how. But is the aspiration wrong? Sri Aurobindo would say, no, it's an aspiration. Keep it. It won't come like this. It won't be in an imperfect body, that's for sure. But the aspiration itself, we reconcile. And the same with mind, that, well, human life is like that, prone to error, you explain by karma and whatever. But why don't I have the knowledge? So many times, we all would have, felt it sometimes, that when we were in an act which would have repercussions, why didn't I think or know? Isn't it? So, you see how aspiration awakens. Now, ordinarily you will say these are all karmic transactions, end of the story. But it's very imperfect, very incomplete. So the moment this aspiration awakens towards perfection, I wish that the mind could be omniscient. In traditional yoga, we will be told only God is omniscient. Even the seer and the saint, they will know intuitively. Though we want, we expect, at least the saint should know everything. But if a saint, being a human, can know everything, you can also know everything. Similarly, we want, I wish I could love in a much better way. But the heart invariably gets torn in all kinds of conflicts. So this is a sign that within us is a seed of perfection. And those in whom this aspiration has developed are the ones who are meant for Sri Aurobindo's yoga. And that's why, people say we are so few. Often they lament. I say, what do you want? You know, it's not like another religious movement where too many people are coming, doing pranam, doing matha tekna. It should not be. It will finish by some standards, talk, explanations. It is a serious issue, and truly speaking, Sri Aurobindo's yoga actually begins only when the aspiration for a greater perfection in this life, here, that begins. And if it is not there, okay, it's a good preparation to know a little bit. We do guru shopping, so we have book shopping and all kinds of philosophy shopping. But the real thing comes with aspiration. So we'll stop with this and continue after the break in 10 minutes' time.